Why don't we just take a walk before we go home? Debbie suggests. I need to work off that twice-baked potato. What do you say? Gwen says yes. Not wanting to be the lone party pooper, Cam reluctantly agrees. She keeps a distance from the cigarette fumes as they walk. The sidewalks are crowded tonight with tourists, strolling retirees, roving groups of teenagers. Debbie buys a box of saltwater taffy as they pass one of the ubiquitous stands and offers it around. Are you kidding? That will pull out every filling I have. Gwen shakes her head. Plus, how do you eat so much and stay so thin? Petra throws her cigarette down on the sidewalk and grinds it with the toe of her sandal. Fast metabolism. Debbie blithely unwraps another piece of taffy. Casey's like that. My boys are like that, too, Petra tells Gwen. They fill themselves up with all kinds of crap. Fast food, candy, soda, chips, and they never gain a pound. Half the time I live on broccoli and salad, and look at me. Same here, Gwen says, as Cam sneaks another peek at her watch, and Debbie stops walking to peer into a shop window. And Casey's a tiny little thing, too, like our friend here.
Who, me?
Debbie crumples a taffy wrapper.
Let's go check out this store. I like that beach bag.
Don't you have one just like it? Cam asks.
Not exactly.
Debbie tosses the wrapper toward a garbage can, misses, doesn't bother to pick it up.
Come on.
Cam reluctantly follows the three of them into the store. It's a beach boutique just like countless other beach boutiques up and down the main drag. Brightly lit, crowded, filled with t-shirts, sunscreen, jewelry, souvenirs. Debbie decides to try on a couple of bathing suits and disappears into the dressing room. Gwen hunts through bracelets, wanting to buy one for her daughter as a gift.
I'm going to go out for another smoke, Petra decides. Want to come?
No, Cam says quickly. I want to browse a little. What she really wants is to go home. They checked in on the kids less than 10 minutes ago. They were playing Scene It and having a blast. Still, Cam doesn't like leaving Tess at night after all that's happened.
Like what?
She asks herself, gazing into a jewelry case at a collection of earrings. Nothing's happened. You're just feeling like something might.
Which do you like better? Gwen asks, nearby.
Cam turns and sees her holding out two shiny charms. One is a starfish, the other a lighthouse. Both have dangling silver flags etched New Jersey.
They're both nice.
Yeah? Maybe I'll get her both then, Gwen says, and drifts away. Cam looks back at the jewelry case, wondering if there's anything in it Tess might like.
Can I help you, ma'am?
A dreadlocked, college-aged sales girl asks.
No, thank you. I was just...
She breaks off as something catches her eye. Her pulse quickens up as she leans in to get a better look.
Would you like to see some earrings, ma'am?
Please. The ones right here.
These?
No, those... The black ones with the gold posts. Cam shifts her weight uneasily as the girl lifts them out and hands them across the glass counter. The moment they're in her hand, a wave of dizziness sweeps over Cam. But this time, it's not a vision coming on, just a pervasive sense of foreboding.
Pretty, aren't they?
She nods, her trembling forefinger stroking the glossy triangular pendants.
What kind of stones are these?
Oh, they're not stones. They're shark's teeth. Real ones. Found right here on the island. What could be more providential than a summer house without air conditioning on a stifling July night? Most people could probably think of a number of things. Not me. For me, this is the jackpot. The windows are wide open at the two-story bayfront house in Loveladies, a largely residential community on the island's northern end. There are no blinds or shades to hinder what little sea breeze there is. It's a Peeping Tom's dream come true. Not that I'm a Peeping Tom. I'm not out here with night vision binoculars, getting eaten alive by mosquitoes for kicks. These people aren't big on conserving energy.
Even now, well past midnight, many of the rooms are brightly lit, including two on the first floor. It's an island house, so that's where the smaller bedrooms are, with the main living area, and probably the master suite, on the floor above, with the better view of the water. In a first floor corner room, the view is, quite conveniently, a clump of tall shrubs, the ideal hiding place. Inside, the girl is clearly visible. She's on her bed, painting her toenails a bright, bold pink. It clashes with her sunburnt face and fair, freckled red-headedness, which, if one didn't know better, would appear God-given. I know better. I know what she used to look like, who she used to be. She's wearing a cotton tank top and boxer shorts. Skimpy attire for someone who's sitting in front of a window that anyone might come along and look into, for God's sake. There's something around her neck. Can it be? It's impossible to tell at this angle, even through the binoculars. I need to get a little closer so that I can... A twig snaps with the forward movement. The telltale sound seems to boom through the night. Did she hear? How could she not? But the girl, whatever she's calling herself these days, hasn't so much as glanced up from her toes. Ah, there's the reason. In her long orange-red hair, crimped from its usual daytime braids, thin white earphone cords are plainly visible. She's plugged into something, deaf to a stray footfall outside her window. Does anyone her age ever listen anymore? Do they really need that constant noise to fill their heads? It's not noise, it's music. That's what they probably say to their elders, who just don't get it. It's what I used to say myself. But that really was music back then. What kids listen to today, with its throbbing beat and angry words that are shouted, not sung, and thus barely qualify as lyrics, isn't music. The girl screws the polished brush back into the bottle, leans back on her elbows, and extends her freckled legs into the air, waving her painted toes back and forth as if to dry them. At this angle, with her head thrown back, her neck is plainly visible. And yes, hanging from a silver chain, there is a black shark's tooth. So, she got the little gift from a so-called secret admirer. Does she have any idea who it's from? Ha! If she did, she wouldn't be wearing it. There she sits, clueless, unaware that her shameless masquerade is about to come to a close. There she sits, pretending to be somebody else. But I know exactly who she is. Anger is beginning to seep in, along with a surge of adrenaline that makes it almost impossible to just stand here in the shadows and watch. But it isn't time yet. Not tonight. Tomorrow will come soon enough. And then she'll be mine. Mine. Chapter 9. Did you pack that extra sunscreen I left on your bed last night? Cam stands over Tess, kneeling on her bedroom floor, zipping and unzipping the pockets on her bulging duffel bag as if she's looking for something. Yeah, got it. But it's not like we'll be on the beach. I mean, there's no beach in D.C., right? There's sun in D.C. Make sure you protect your skin. You're so fair, you'll burn in a second. And I won't be there to remind you. A memory flashes into Cam's head, chasing Tess on the beach a good 12 years ago, her little girl wearing nothing but a diaper and a broad-brimmed floppy hat, all that tender baby skin exposed, and Tess screaming when Cam caught her, wriggling maniacally as she smeared sunscreen over chubby legs and arms and wrangled her into a ruffly pink swimsuit. Mom, I've got everything you put on the list and a lot of extra stuff, too. You don't need to stand over me and catalog things. But Cam does need to. What about the charger for your cell phone? She asks her daughter. I don't think I remembered to write it on the list. You did. So did you pack it? I'm pretty sure. Tess peers into a side pouch. Is it there? I'm not looking for it.
What are you looking for?
Nothing. Just making sure I've got everything, okay?
I'm bugging her, but I can't help it.
Well, if you forgot anything important, let Dad know.
Tess nods and unzips another compartment. Cam checks the digital clock on the night table, then sneaks a peek at her own reflection in the mirror above the bureau. She's looking pretty damn good for 7:25 in the morning, thank you very much. She's looking pretty good for any hour of any recent day, actually. She's made sure of it. She set the alarm for 5:45, but was awake a half hour before it rang, nervous about what lies ahead. She got up and got busy, using a special conditioning pack on her hair in the shower, then blowing it dry, something she rarely bothers to do. She put on makeup that accents her bronze coloring, courtesy of these past few days on the beach. It took her a good 20 minutes trying to find the perfect outfit, something that would flatter her, hide her bump, and be comfortable. Tall order. The heat and humidity didn't break overnight, so she's forced to show more skin than she'd like. Her upper arms, while fleshier than usual, are nicely tanned, bared in a loose-fitting off-white linen tank. With it, she's wearing a crinkly floral print skirt and the beaded hemp anklet she bought last night. When Debbie and Gwen had come out of the dressing room, Cam feigned interest in the jewelry she was still standing beside. Debbie talked her into the ankle bracelet, saying hemp would look hip. Still feeling rattled, Cam mindlessly obliged, but it turns out Debbie was right. With her tanned bare feet, coral pedicured toenails, and cute leather thong sandals, the hemp wrapped around her ankle does look hip. Sexy, even. As hip and sexy as a pregnant middle-aged mom can be, anyway. Even Tess approved. So yeah, Cam looks good today. Which makes her feel good. It's nice to be out of the Terry cover-up and looking presentable for a change. Her stomach is definitely protruding beneath the layered top and skirt, though. If she hadn't been planning to spill her news to Mike when he gets here, she'd have to carry around a bag of groceries or something.
Uh-oh, is that Dad?
Tess asks, as the sound of tires crunching on gravel floats in through the screened window.
Probably. It's time.
Why, uh-oh?
Because I'm not ready yet.
Outside, the engine cuts off, a door slams, footsteps on the path.
Can you tell him I need another few minutes?
She's stalling, Cam realizes. Her bag is packed, she's dressed and ready. Why prolong it? Then again, who cares? Cam needs time alone with Mike.
No problem.
Take 5 minutes. Take 10. She closes Tess's bedroom door behind her and heads down the short hall to the living room, which she straightened before going to bed last night. The simple chintz and wicker cottage furniture, rag rugs, and board floors look charming with the sunlight streaming in the windows. On the weathered pine coffee table, a vase of violet-colored flowers she picked from the yard last night, and a stack of magazines arranged in a perfect fan. Too perfect. She pauses to scatter them a little. There, that's better. Then picks up a magazine and holds it casually against her stomach, as if she were just reading. It doesn't camouflage the bump entirely, but it helps. She takes a deep breath and opens the door. Ah, Mike, up close and in person. A 4th of July sky lights up inside her, and if she's not mistaken, he's pretty happy to see her, too. Or maybe he's just glad to be out of the city, glad to have the long weekend, glad about leaving with Tess. Whatever. He looks good, familiar, clean-shaven, his light brown hair cut short and a little stubbly on top. He's wearing a polo shirt, khaki shorts, deck shoes. Hi, he says, and holds out a gold cardboard box. These are for you.
Chocolates. Not drugstore chocolates, but Godiva.
Her stomach quivers at the sight of them, and not necessarily out of queasiness.
Thank you.
She tries not to smile too big, tries not to seem surprised. Mike brought her chocolates.
What does this mean?
You're welcome.
He's smiling at her.
What does that mean?
Tess isn't ready just yet. Come on in.
Okay, thanks.
He steps over the threshold he's crossed hundreds, maybe thousands of times before, into a house that is, technically, still his. Cam catches a familiar whiff of his aftershave, and scenes from countless mornings of sharing a bathroom sink flash through her brain.
How's Tess? Mike asks. She said she made a new friend. What's her name again?
Beth.
Right. Do you like her?
Cam hesitates, just long enough for Mike to say,
uh-oh.
No, I like her. She just seems, I don't know, older than Tess. More mature, like the rest of the girls their age, I guess. I feel like Tess is still a little girl. I guess that's because she still looks like one.
Thank God. Is she still hung up on what happened back home?
Not really.
Cam is surprised Mike even asked about that. Back in June, when she told him what had happened, he didn't seem the least bit concerned. What he'd said was, oh, thank God. She had a fight with her friends? I thought you were going to say something really awful happened, the way you sounded.
Cam, having just spent the rest of the day in a doctor's waiting room for a tetanus shot, then the better part of the night trying to console her sobbing, wounded, limping daughter, knew Mike just didn't get it. Not because he's a man, because he's always been a loving, tender, sensitive guy. No, he didn't get how bad it was because he wasn't there. Period. You can leave and say you're going to be a hands-on parent and see your child on every occasion you're officially supposed to, and then some. But when you don't live under the same roof, you just don't get it. And Cam told him so. He wasn't exactly thrilled to hear it. But she doesn't want to remember that argument now. Time to move on. Want coffee? She brewed some, with him in mind.
If you're having it?
She's not. Come on into the kitchen, she says, and leads the way. The beach house kitchen is nothing like the sleek, stainless and granite one in the Montclair house. Outdated appliances, worn laminate, stock cabinetry. They always said they'd remodel it someday. She pours him a cup of coffee, adds milk and a packet of Splenda without asking, and hands it to him.
Thanks. You're not having any?
No, I'm good. Why don't you sit down? She expects him to protest, or at the very least, check his watch. To her surprise, he pulls out a chair for her, then one for himself, and sits. The table is in a sunny nook off one end of the kitchen. The morning light casts a warm glow over everything. How to begin? Last night and this morning, she rehearsed what she was going to say, but suddenly the script has been erased from her brain. What matters more, though, than how to begin is when to begin, and the answer is now. They're on the opposite end of the house from Tess's room. She won't overhear if she stays put, but she won't for long, and Cam has to talk fast.
Listen, I need to tell you something.
The words come from Mike's mouth, but he could have stolen them from her own. That's it. That's exactly what she was going to say. Every version of her rehearsed speech began with those words. I need to tell you something. So now he needs to tell her something? What can it be? Judging by the solemn look on Mike's face, it's serious. But he brought chocolates.
So?
He gave her Godiva on Valentine's Day, too, just weeks before moving out. And he gave Tess that expensive camera. Maybe today's gift was just to appease the pain of whatever's coming. Is he going to tell her he wants to file divorce papers? Or that he's met someone else? Or wants to put the Montclair house or this cottage on the market? Whatever it is, he'll have to keep it to himself until she shared her own news, because her news might make him change his mind about filing papers, officially moving on without her.
Mike, wait. You need to know.
She chickens out.
Say it. Just say it.
What? He asks expectantly. The words are lodged in her throat. Before you say anything, Cam, I have to tell you.
That's it. That does it.
Mike has just unwittingly performed a verbal Heimlich, and a frantic-sounding, "I'm pregnant," comes flying out of her. He goes utterly still. "I'm pregnant," she repeats decisively, with a firm nod in case there's any doubt in his mind. There, it's out. At last he knows. In Cam's mental rehearsals of the scene, and there were many, Mike's initial reaction to her news was just as it is now, dumbfounded, jaw-dropping silence. Ah, she knows him well. But maybe not as well as she thought, because his greenish-hazel eyes turn to stone, and he recovers his voice more quickly than she'd expected. "Whose is it?" It's Cam's turn to be dumbfounded, but only for a split second.
"It's yours."
Damn him.
"How can you even ask me such a—"
"It's mine, yet you didn't tell me."
"I'm telling you now, and please keep your voice down," she adds crisply. "Tess doesn't know."
He swallows audibly, shakes his head, and she almost feels sorry for him. Almost. "Whose is it? How dare he?" She glares at him. He doesn't seem to notice. "What?" he begins, then clears his throat, swallows again. "I mean, when are you due?"
"Sometime between Halloween and Thanksgiving."
"You don't know?" "The doctor said it's hard to tell because I was regular and—" She trails off, feeling like the details are too intimate to share with him, which is ridiculous, since they've already had a baby together and lived a life together, and if anyone knows every intimate detail about her, it's Mike. It was Mike, anyway. The sunlight that had seemed so cheerful just a short time ago now feels harsh. In its glare, Mike's eyes are rimmed by dark circles and a fine network of wrinkles. He's tired, and he's getting older. They both are. Half a lifetime together, and still there's so much he doesn't know about her. What if she tells him the rest right here and now? About the visions that caused her to start drinking in the first place, and how they've come back to haunt her now. Fewer and farther between, less graphic, but somehow more foreboding than ever before. About her growing worry, perhaps irrational, please God, irrational, over Tess's well-being. It would be such a relief to unburden herself on the one person who deserves the whole truth, but that might be the nail in the coffin. If she couldn't bring herself to tell Mike back in the old days when things were good between them, how can she possibly tell him now, when their life together is on the brink of destruction? Maybe if she keeps all that to herself, they still have a chance. He sighs. "What are we going to do?"
"I don't know."
"We." He said we. That's a good sign. Well, of course he said we. He's a grown man, she reminds herself. A husband and father, not some 15-year-old kid with a knocked-up girlfriend. And he isn't talking about terminating the pregnancy when he asks what they're going to do. He's talking about bringing a baby into the current state of their marriage. With a pang, she remembers being in labor with Tess, remembers how at the hospital Mike never left her side for a moment, though the nurse explained that the bedside chair turned into a cot and encouraged the father-to-be to get some rest. "Your wife is going to need you later," the nurse said. "My wife needs me now," Mike replied.
"What about later?"
"I'll be there. I'm fine." Day turned into night, and night into the wee hours of the morning.
"Just try to get some sleep,"
Cam urged Mike, and the nurse turned the chair into a bed, brought sheets, a blanket, a pillow. Mike spent all of 2 minutes lying on the chair turned cot as Cam labored in stoic silence in the hospital bed. Then the chair was a chair again, and Mike was sitting in it, holding her hand, watching her anxiously.
"I thought I told you to get some sleep," the nurse barked when she came back.
"Have you ever tried to sleep on that thing?" Mike retorted. "It's like a torture device." He never moved until it was time for Tess, a wet, sticky newborn, to slide into his hands. Cam will never forget the look on his face in that moment, just as she'll never forget the look on his face in this,
If she thought her news was going to heal whatever had gone wrong between them, she was wrong. Dead wrong.
"Did you sleep well, dear?" asks the guest house owner, who introduced herself yesterday afternoon as Martha, or Margaret. She's watering a potted fern at the foot of the stairs as Lucinda comes down.
"I slept very well, thanks," she lies.
The mattress was a sagging, spring-studded spine killer, especially after all those exhausting hours spent papering the island with Leah Roby flyers.
"Most people do sleep well here. There's nothing like fresh salt air. It's good for the soul."
Window air conditioning, Lucinda can't help but think, would be even better for the soul, or at least for the body. She was initially so relieved to have found a place to stay on short notice that she found herself charmed by the attic bedroom with its whitewashed sloping walls and gabled windows. Sure, it was hot up there, but she optimistically decided that that was just the afternoon sun beaming in. Evenings are supposed to cool down nicely at the shore, right? Wrong. After a night of tossing on the miserable mattress and sweating profusely, she has a good idea why she was actually able to find a vacancy at a beachside island inn on the night before a holiday weekend. She'd love to check out of the Briar Beach House and return to the climate-controlled, pillow-topped comfort of her apartment back in Philadelphia. But something tells her to stick around. And it has nothing to do with Randy being a stone's throw away. Or with his parting words yesterday. "Give me a call tomorrow, and we'll talk some more." He wants to help her with the case, she's sure. The case. The main reason she's here. The only reason you're here, keep that in mind.
"Why don't you go on into the dining porch for breakfast?" the owner suggests.
Lucinda hesitates.
"It's included in the room,"
the woman mentions, as if that will convince her. She has no idea she's talking to a real live heiress, an heiress in shorts and sneakers, whose family would have disinherited her if they could have kept it out of the papers. Publicity is the Sloanes' worst enemy.
"Thank you,"
Lucinda says politely.
"Martha, is it?"
The woman nods her white head, pleased. Lucinda crosses through a wallpapered parlor cluttered with far too many cheap knickknacks, following the sound of clinking silverware and mute conversation to the small screened dining porch. Frank Sinatra is playing jauntily in the background. Overhead paddle fans do little to stir the air, which smells of toast, coffee, and mildew. There isn't an empty table among the four, where the handful of other guests are sipping coffee and eating breakfast. Lucinda can either choose to join the most harmless-looking of the bunch, or forego coffee and forced small talk, and walk right back out again. That seems rude. So she heads toward the only table that has just one person sitting there. Its occupant, a middle-aged woman, looks up abruptly from her New York Times. "Do you mind if I join you?"
"No, it's fine," she says a little stiffly. And Lucinda knows that it's not fine at all. Frankly, she doesn't blame the woman. She herself is never thrilled when forced to share a table or even a train seat with a total stranger. It isn't that Lucinda is shy, far from it, or a snob, or unfriendly. For her, the problem is that, in close quarters, she tends to get impressions about people, especially strangers. Sometimes she knows things their closest confidants might not even know. For example, not only does this woman, in gold earrings and a trim navy top, not want to be bothered, but she's hiding something. That's what flashes through Lucinda's head in the moment after she sits down, and she wishes she hadn't.
"Coffee?"
asks a teenaged girl in an apron, appearing with a carafe.
"Thank you."
The girl pours, then asks the woman if she'd like a warm-up. She merely shakes her head. She seriously wants to be left alone. The unwelcoming vibe is so palpable, the girl with the coffee pot can surely feel it too. What's up with her? Does she have a deep, dark secret? Did she come here to the island without telling anyone where she was going?
She's keeping something hidden, if not herself. That's what Lucinda's intuition tells her. Intrigued, she wants to know more. She can't help it. "You're just nosy," she tells herself. But she can't help wondering if it's something more than that. If the woman's presence is more sinister than standoffish. Hard to tell. She stirs sugar and plenty of half and half into her coffee, then takes a sip. It's awful. Watery and lukewarm. Quelle surprise. This place really is a bad roadside motel masquerading as a seaside inn. She sets her cup back into the saucer, then announces to her table mate, "I'm Lucinda." "Nice to meet you," the woman murmurs, eyes on the times.
"I didn't catch your name?"
Cornered, the woman says, with a look of resignation and a crisp snap of her newspaper as she turns the page, "It's Kathy." There are so many questions flitting through Mike's brain. He couldn't get answers to them if he had all day. And you don't. Any second now, Tess is going to appear and this conversation will screech to an immediate halt, which is probably best for now. He needs to get away from Cam, needs to process this news and figure out what to do about it. He glances at the door. No Tess.
"Say something, Mike."
Cam looks shaken. That pisses him off and he snaps, "How long have you known?"
"That I'm pregnant?"
At his curt nod, she admits.
"Since March."
"March. Over 3 months. Staggering."
"You knew before I left and you let me go anyway?"
"I knew right after you left. On St. Patrick's Day. You were already gone."
Yes, he was.
He remembers St. Patrick's Day well, watching the parade, drinking green beer afterward at an Irish pub somewhere in the East 50s with a bunch of guys he barely knew. No need to keep an eye on his watch and the commuter train schedule in his head. All he had to do was grab a cab for downtown whenever he felt like calling it a night. If he'd only known. If Cam had called him the day, damn it, the second she found out, he'd have come right back.
Would you really?
He'd felt so damn claustrophobic then. News like this might have pushed him further away. The most bitter irony of all. He walked into this house today planning to tell Cam he still loves her, that he wants to come home. Now what? Now, he isn't so sure. How could she let weeks, months go by without telling him she was pregnant? Didn't she think he had a right to know sooner? He looks at her. Just 5 minutes ago, he was sitting here thinking how glad he was that it's this morning and not last night. How glad he was that it isn't Kate sitting across the table from him. It might as well be, though. Cam feels like a stranger.
"How could you keep something like this from me?"
"Because that's what she does," a voice answers in his head, sounding suspiciously like his father's. But it's his own. He's older. Wiser, wearier, just like his father. She builds walls and hides behind them. She's been doing it for years. How can anyone have an honest relationship that way? Frustrated, Mike reaches for the coffee he didn't really want, just for something to do. It's too milky and not hot enough, and lands in an acrid pool in his stomach. He'd already drunk too much of it in the car on the way down, in an effort to combat a mostly sleepless night after telling Kate he was going back to his wife. She didn't react well, accused him of using her, asked why he hadn't just told her before, instead of putting her through an uncomfortable dinner date. "Because I didn't know until now," was his lame reply. "So you're saying that being with me is what convinced you to go back to some other woman?" That was pretty much it, yep. Except that Cam isn't some other woman. She's his wife, still. He wanted to remind Kate of that, but he didn't. He wanted to feel sorry for her, too. But in the end, he couldn't do that either. She's too hard, too bitter. She's not Cam. But do I even know Cam at all? Aren't you supposed to know someone better and better the more time you spend with them? In their marriage, it's been the opposite. With every year that's passed, Cam has become more remote. The funny thing is, today, when she opened the door and smiled at him, he thought he glimpsed the old Cam. In that instant, he felt that he was doing the right thing coming back, giving their marriage another chance. He thought it right up until she dropped her bombshell. He looks up at her again, and something stirs in his gut, in his heart, despite his anger. "Can't you say something?" she asks again. He can, and he does, the first thing that pops into his head. "Tess said you don't drink anymore." Obviously caught off guard, Cam looks away, as if she doesn't like the idea of Tess and Mike talking about her behind her back. "Is this why you stopped?" he asks.
"You mean the pregnancy?"
"Yeah."
"There were a lot of reasons."
"So you really did stop? Cold turkey? Just like that?"
She nods.
"Was it hard?"
"Not really," she sounds surprised. "I mean, I started by going to AA, but that's not really for me. Everyone seems so desperate. I know it sounds bad, and everyone there probably says the same thing, but I'm not like them. I never thought I belonged there in the first place."
"Then how did you end up going?"
She hesitates. "This woman, Kathy."
"Who is she?"
She's someone who lives back home.
"In Montclair? A friend of yours?"
"No, I used to see her around the neighborhood a lot, and she was always friendly. We got to talking a few times. It sounds crazy because she's really a stranger, but I always felt like I knew her, in a way."
"It does sound crazy," Mike says, trying to picture Cam letting anyone into her private world, much less a total stranger.
"Anyway, she'd mentioned that she used to have a drinking problem, and I knew she went to AA. She used to talk about it a lot, and one day, she just asked me if I wanted to come to a meeting with her."
"Why would she do that?"
"I don't know. Maybe she thought I had a problem, too."
"Maybe it was obvious that you did," Mike thinks grimly. "So you went with her?" he asks Cam, incredulous.
"No, not then. I mean, even when I finally went to a meeting, I never went with Kathy. But when I realized I had to do something about it, I knew where to go. And I knew she'd be there. And of course, she became my sponsor."
"Of course?"
Mike doesn't know how AA works, but for some reason it bothers him, the thought of Cam telling a total stranger about her problems when she wouldn't even open up to her own husband. "You're just jealous," he tells himself. "You need to get over it. Be glad she's sober."
"So are you still going to AA then?"
"No, because I'm over the hurdle and..."
On the other end of the house, a door creaks. Cam breaks off. They both look toward the sound of footsteps, along with a heavy thudding. Tess is coming, lugging her bag along with her. Cam reaches across the table, lays a hand on his forearm. He realizes she's trembling, and again, something stirs inside him.
"Don't say anything to her, Mike," she says in a low voice. "About the baby, promise me. We should tell her together when we know what we're going to do."
"What do you want to do?"
"Have the baby. Raise it," she shrugs. "You can be a part of things, or not."
"It's my child. Did you think I wouldn't want to be a part of things?"
"That's not what I meant."
He knew that, but he can't resist making this harder than it has to be. "What did you mean?"
"You can come back, or you can be a single dad, with a visitation schedule for the baby, just like you have for Tess."
"Yeah, sure. It's hard enough for Cam to let a 14-year-old walk out the door. How is she going to send an infant away for hours, even days at a time? It would be so much simpler for all of them if he just moved back home." "Simpler? Is that a good reason to go back? Because it's simpler?" Tess appears in the doorway.
"Dad!"
"There's my girl."
Mike stands, hurries to hug her. Hard.
"Ready to hit the road?"
"Yeah. Mom?"
She goes over to Cam, still sitting at the table.
Are you sure you'll be okay?
I'll be fine, Cam says brightly, unconvincingly. Have a great time in Washington. Give my regards to George.
Which George?
Take your pick. DC's full of Georges, right? Her tone is forced.
Whatever. Have fun.
Love you, Mom.
Love you too, Tess. Mike, already halfway to the door with Tess's bag, doesn't say anything at all. Chapter 10. Ike figures he probably shouldn't be driving in his condition. What else is new? He doesn't have far to go, and he knows these streets as well as he knows his own face in the mirror. Wait. Bad comparison. Glancing at his reflection in the rearview mirror, he sees an old man looking back at him. How the hell did this happen? Some nights, when he's flying high, sitting in with a band for a set or two, beating those drums and singing his heart out, he feels like he's 20 again. Yeah, and some mornings after, he wakes up feeling like he's 90 and has just been hit by a garbage truck, smelling like it, too. The worst is when he has no recollection of what happened the night before. Well, that's what you get when you party too hard. Or when you're getting too old. This was one of those mornings. Last thing he remembers was being on the mainland, somewhere in Manahawkin, jamming with a friend. That was sometime yesterday. Or was it? It's too damn easy to lose track of time these days. Ike never was one to bother with a watch, much less a calendar. But this is getting ridiculous lately. Anyway, he was in Manahawkin, and the next thing he knew, he was waking up in his own back seat this morning in a familiar parking lot. So he obviously found his way to Long Beach Island. That was fine with him. He got a greasy egg sandwich for breakfast, then stopped in at a few of his favorite haunts for some hair of the dog. Then he remembered that it's summer now, and his daughter and her family are on the island. So he decided to surprise them. It's been a while since he's seen everyone, and a man needs family, especially when that's all he's really got left in the world. Just his daughter, his son-in-law, his granddaughter, and Brenda, wherever she is. An image flits into Ike's brain and is gone. Brenda's face. Huh. Did he see her somewhere again? Maybe last night? The Brenda in his vision just now was beautiful and young. Must just be a long-ago memory popping up to taunt him. He couldn't have seen her, not looking like that. She might have been a teenager when they met, but she'd be a senior citizen by now. Still beautiful, but sure as hell not young. Even Ava wouldn't be young now. She'd be middle-aged. Would Ike recognize her if he saw her? Probably. She always looked so much like Cam. Then again, people change. They get older, grayer, wrinkled. They have plastic surgery, dye their hair, gain and lose weight. Hell, half the time you don't even recognize yourself in the mirror. Meaning there's a good chance Ike wouldn't know his own daughter, his own wife, if he came face to face with them today. That's why it's important to look beyond surface appearances, because you just never know. As he pulls up in front of Cam's beach house, Ike sees her station wagon with the oval LBI sticker in the rear window. He's vaguely reluctant to park his crappy old car in the driveway behind his daughter's Volvo, but it's much easier to do down here on the island than in Cam's fancy neighborhood in Montclair. Anyway, Ike reminds himself, she won't care what the neighbors think, there or here, because he raised her right. Still. He tucks his t-shirt into his jeans and pulls a rubber band around his straggly gray hair before walking toward the front door.
I can't believe you came with us, Debbie tells Cam as they emerge from the crisp, air-conditioned car into what feels like a hot, sopping sponge.
I can't believe it either.
Nor can Cam believe Debbie isn't calling out to Jonathan, who has already scrambled out and is racing through the parking lot toward Ships Ahoy, the waterside entertainment complex.
So, why did you come?
Cam hesitates. She really isn't sure. When Debbie called earlier this afternoon, she was on the couch in front of the fan, with a cup of iced herbal tea and a stack of marble notebooks on the table. She couldn't bring herself to go through them just yet, but she was planning to. She wasn't going to budge for the rest of the day. The rest of the weekend, really. But for some reason, she heard herself tell Debbie yes when she meant to say no. So here she is, going to a mini-golf course up the highway, a painstaking trip in holiday weekend island traffic. She must be out of her mind. Which is what she says to Debbie now, in exactly those words.
Yes, you must be out of your mind, Debbie agrees with a shrug, aiming her key remote at the car and locking it with a double staccato chirp.
But I'm glad you are, or I'd be having no fun by myself.
Instead, we can have no fun together, is that it? Cam asks, and Debbie grins.
That's exactly it. Too bad Petra and Gwen didn't come along, too.
Yeah, well, they're not crazy.
For the record, Petra is crazy, but she said no. Her kids are with her ex.
Petra has shared custody with her ex-husband, who lives across the causeway.
And Gwen's not home, or I bet I could have talked her into it.
Maybe not. Unlike Cam, Gwen probably didn't wake up this morning with reconciliation on her mind. Gwen didn't spend the day obsessing over everything she said, everything he said, everything either of them could have said, didn't say. She didn't have notebooks filled with notes about horrific visions of missing persons, mostly traumatized children, that she was planning to reread this weekend, just in case. Well, just in case.
Nope, that was me. And I guess I'm here because I needed to escape all of that.
Anything, even mini golf, sounded better than spending another solitary moment in that cottage.
Talk about a crowd scene, Debbie murmurs, as they walk around a car that has its turn signal on, waiting for a space.
This place is always jammed.
You've been here before?
Oh, yeah. I think I've been to every mini-golf place on the island. Tess loves it.
Mike does, too.
Not Cam. Probably because she was never any good at it. It's not easy to hit a ball through a moving paddle wheel after a couple of glasses of wine.
Who knows? Maybe now she'll be able to hit a hole-in-one.
But neither Tess nor Mike will be here to see it, she reminds herself, glumly.
Come on, Mom!
Up ahead, Jonathan darts around a minivan that's backing out of a parking spot. Cam fights back the urge to tell him to be careful. He's not her child, not her responsibility. Her child is miles away, someone else's responsibility this weekend.
Someone else?
Mike, her dad.
You can't really blame him, she tells herself yet again, for how he reacted.
He was blindsided by the news. Once he's had time to let it sink in,
what?
He'll say he wants to come home? That doesn't seem likely. But there were a few minutes there before Cam broke her news when she could have sworn something had sparked between them again. Maybe that was just wishful thinking, the heat, pregnancy hormones. Or maybe it was real. Maybe once the dust settles.
Did you go to the beach today? Debbie asks.
No, did you?
Nope, too hot for the beach.
Cam laughs.
I thought hot days were perfect beach days. Isn't that the whole point?
Not if you don't go into the water. Who wants to sit and bake all day?
You can always go into the water. No matter how cold it is, on a day like this, it would feel great.
I don't go into the water here.
Why not?
Sharks, Debbie shudders. This is where the movie Jaws happened, you know.
That was supposed to be New England. It was based on something here in Beach Haven, a great white attack. Haven't you ever heard about it?
Who hasn't? The rogue shark is island lore. Cam's father told her about it, in gory detail, when she was a little girl. She remembers the incident well. They were in a pool room somewhere on the island, and one of Pop's friends, some biker chick with yellow hair and dark roots, who hung around the band for a few summers, scolded him.
Why would you scare a little kid like that, Ike?
Look at her, Pop said with a laugh and pointed at Cam. Does she seem scared to you?
In truth, she was. But she was careful to hide that fear, and every other. Pop was always boasting about how grown up she was, how resilient, how independent. She worried that if she showed him the slightest insecurity, he'd leave her behind.
Yeah, she tells Debbie. Of course I've heard about it. But it happened a long time ago.
You think it can't happen now?
Debbie's tone is challenging, almost amused. For some reason, that bothers Cam.
Of course I don't think that. It can happen anywhere, anytime.
That's the point, Debbie says ominously.
She's talking about a shark attack, but something shifts uneasily in the back of Cam's mind. All day, brooding over Mike, she's felt a lingering trepidation as well. She can't pinpoint the cause, or what it is she's even worried about. It's as if the sky is clear, and the meteorologists haven't forecast rain, yet Cam is certain a storm is brewing.
You feel it in your bones, as her mother-in-law might say.
Maybe it really does have something to do with the oppressive weather, and nothing more than that.
Have you heard from Tess yet?
Debbie asks, removing her own phone from her pocket and checking it as they walk.
She called earlier.
What did she say?
That they were there, checked into the hotel.
And?
And that was it.
Her conversation with Tess was stilted, and she knew Mike was right there. Not that she thought Tess would confide anything earth-shattering, even if she was having a conversation out of his earshot. But it bothered her that he was there, and that she was here.
Come on, face it. You're just jealous that Mike gets to spend the weekend with Tess, and you have to spend it alone.
Or at least without Tess. She did try to reach her father. Maybe he'll call back and come visit, or Cam can go to him, wherever he is. Someplace nearby, she's certain. Maybe even here on the island. He often plays beach bars at this time of year. Debbie's around, too, but she's getting on Cam's nerves already.
You should have stayed home.
Why are you here, on your feet, in the heat? Feeling claustrophobic, she takes off her sunglasses. They seem to be trapping hot air against her face.
Hey, are you wearing makeup?
She looks up to see Debbie looking curiously at her.
You mean it hasn't all melted off?
I've never seen you in makeup, says Debbie, whom Cam has never seen without it. You look nice.
Thanks.
Something about the way Debbie's looking at her tells Cam she's not going to drop the subject. And she's right.
So, why do you have it on?
Why else? I wanted to look my best for mini golf. Cam quips.
Doesn't everyone?
Come on. You wanted to look good for your ex-husband.
Right, Cam says with a shrug. Why bother to deny it? Who cares if Debbie's on to her?
I hope you got fixed up just to show the creep what he's missing, and not because you thought you might win him back. Because trust me, that's not going to happen, Debbie says flatly.
It never does.
Annoyed, Cam shifts her gaze away, instinctively checking on Jonathan. There he is, up ahead, waiting in front of a concrete block wall that's painted bright blue. On it, red bubble letters spell out, Ships Ahoy, Miniature Golf.
Walking back toward his car, Ike scowls. He comes all this way, and nobody's home?
You could have called first, Pop, Cam's voice says in his head.
I never call, he retorts.
Never has, never will. You can't change the way you do things at this stage of the game. Hell, Ike couldn't change the way he did things from the very beginning, not even for Brenda.
But that's not why she left.
No?
Why'd she leave? Not because I needed my space, that's for damn sure.
Brenda wasn't the kind of woman who needed a husband with a 9-to-5 job, coming through the door at the same time every night, or even coming through the door every night. Brenda liked her space, like he did. They were good together that way. not so good together in other ways. But I never stopped trying. I never walked away for good, not like you did, Bren, if that's what you did. Maybe someone took her away. Maybe she's dead. Maybe she's not. Frustrated, Ike looks back at Cam's cottage, wondering if he should stick around waiting for someone to come home, or leave. The air is muggy and still. A mosquito buzzes somewhere around his ear, and he swats it away. It's too hot to hang around here waiting. For all he knows, they went back to Montclair in Mike's car. He does have a key to their place. Cam insisted on giving one to him, back when they first bought the cottage, and it's presumably still tucked into his wallet somewhere. "Use the house any time, Dad," she said.
"You can crash there whenever you're on the island, whether we're there or not."
Maybe he should let himself in now. Wait for someone to come home. Maybe he shouldn't. Climbing behind the wheel of his car, Ike reaches for the beer in the cup holder. The bottle's warm and just about empty, but he swallows the backwash. Feeling a twitch on his bare forearm, he sees that the mosquito has landed there, right on top of his tattoo. He slaps it, hard, with his other hand. Did he get it? Lifting his hand, he sees that he did, and winces. Brenda is smeared with fresh blood. Some kind of omen? She believed in them. Maybe Ike does, too. Shaking his head, he reaches into his pocket for his wallet. Yeah, the key is there. Good. He'll just go into the house and wash off the blood. Get cleaned up a little. Ships Ahoy, Miniature Golf. Golf. The last word, the last two letters jump out at Cam. L.F. The paint on the sign must be fresh, she thinks irrationally, because it's dripping down the wall. No, it's not paint at all, it's blood. Cam blinks and the blood is gone. But she notices, for the first time, that a girl is standing there. There, at the far right side of the sign. It's her. Oh, my God. It's her. Cam breaks into a run, hurtling herself through the crowd toward the girl. Cam, what the hell are you doing? Debbie calls behind her. Cam ignores her, eyes fastened on the girl. She's about Tess's age, cute, a carrot top with a pair of braids that hung just past her chin. Her freckled cheeks are sunburnt. She's wearing a green cotton top that has spaghetti straps tied in little bows over her shoulders, also freckled and sunburnt. Her feet are in white sandals, her toenails polished hot pink. Around her neck is a silver chain, with some kind of small triangular black pendant hanging from it. A shark's tooth. In her hand is an oversized waffle cone of chocolate ice cream, studded with fudgy chunks. It's melting in the blazing sun, dripping over her hand. The girl licks it, her face flushed and shiny, her bangs damp. The ice cream is dripping and the girl is licking and laughing and looking at someone beside her, but Cam doesn't see who it is. She zeroes in on the chocolate oozing over the hands, and the chocolate, like the paint, becomes blood. Blood is dripping over the girl's hands, and now it's smeared all over her clothes and her face and her hair. And she's not laughing. She's crying. She's screaming in terror. Cam blinks again to shut out the gory image, and the girl is laughing again, licking chocolate ice cream off her hand. But something's going to happen to her. She's in danger. Cam pushes her way forward. She has to get to her. Has to warn her. Sorry, excuse me, someone says, and her path is momentarily blocked by a family. Mother pushing baby carriage, father carrying toddler on his shoulders. They pass, and Cam realizes that the spot where the girl was standing is empty. No, please no, don't disappear. Looking around frantically, she sees a flash of green in the crowd. There she goes. Wait! She darts in that direction, eyes peeled, but the crowd shifts, swallows the girl. She's gone. Cam? Dazed, she looks up. There's Debbie with Jonathan at her side.
Are you okay? What are you doing?
Oh, I thought I saw someone I knew, but I lost her.
Well, you'll never find her again in this madhouse.
I have to, Cam thinks grimly. I have to find her. I have to warn her. Then, as she turns away, something catches her eye. She steps closer, and the world screeches to a stop. Coming out of the mini-mart with yet another cold bottle of soda, her umpteenth for the day, Kathy immediately scans the parking lot for Cam. No sign of her. Not surprising. The island is big and crowded. No reason to think she's going to run into Cam at every turn, but that hasn't kept her from looking for her everywhere, just in case. So how long are you really going to hang around in Beach Haven without letting Cam at least know you're here? That depends on how long it will take her to come up with a compelling reason to give Cam regarding why she happens to be here, since I can't tell her the real reason. Wouldn't that be something, though? Imagining Cam's probable reaction if she actually did reveal the truth, Kathy uncaps the bottle and takes a long, unsatisfying swig. Unsatisfying because it won't quench her thirst. She should be drinking water in this heat. And unsatisfying because it's just soda. Unsatisfying. Story of my life. Climbing into her car with the sun beating down is like stepping into Death Valley. Kathy turns the key, rolls down all the windows, sets the air conditioning on high, shifts into reverse, then hesitates, her foot still on the brake. Which way? Back to that horrid, sweltering little guest house with the busybody owner and nosy guests? Or perhaps a walk on the beach? Or is it really time to go find Cam? Maybe just drop in for a friendly little visit? That might freak her out. Yeah, you think? The last thing Kathy wants is to alienate her. Cam has already pulled back, hasn't shown up in Montclair, hasn't returned Kathy's phone calls in days. Still, I need to see her, just to make sure. Her mind made up, Kathy heads toward Cam's cottage. What are you getting, Dad? Tess asks her father. No reply. She sighs. He doesn't seem to hear that, either. He just sits, looking at the menu he's holding, either intently reading every last word on it, or thinking about something else. Tess doubts anyone could be that fixated on seafood and burgers, so it must be the latter. Especially since Dad has seemed quiet and preoccupied all day. It wasn't a big deal in the car, even though the drive down took almost twice as long as it should have, thanks to the holiday traffic. Do you know how long this trip would take in the middle of the night with no traffic? Dad had asked at one point, shaking his head. And it would take a matter of minutes to fly between D.C. and the island.
Then maybe we should have chartered a private plane or something, Tess said with a grin.
Dad didn't return it. He was lost in thought again. Tess plugged into her iPod and listened to music the whole way, which is what she's always done on long road trips with both her parents. She expected her father to protest, since the whole point of the weekend is for them to spend quality time together. But he didn't. He just stared at the windshield at the road, like he had something on his mind. Once, his cell phone rang. He took it out of his pocket, looked at it, then threw it down on the seat.
Aren't you going to answer it? Tess asked.
Nah, it's work. I'm on vacation. But Tess doesn't think it was work at all. When they stopped and he got out to pump gas, she checked his phone. The call had come from someone named Kate. Dad remained subdued while they checked into the hotel with adjoining rooms. Mom would never let Tess have her own room, much less close the door between. Dad doesn't seem to care. He opted to sit by the pool and read a magazine while Tess took a swim. Then, deciding they were both famished, they got dressed for an early dinner, and here they are. Usually, Dad makes an effort to talk to her when they go out to a restaurant together, but he hasn't said anything at all in at least 5 minutes now. It's like he's forgotten Tess is even here. She wonders what he's thinking about, and whether it has anything to do with Kate and the phone call he ignored, or with Mom, maybe. Tess figures the two of them probably had an argument right before she and Dad left this morning. There was definitely some tension when Tess walked into the kitchen. Too bad it took her so long and they had to spend all that time alone together. But she had to make sure she hadn't left behind the one thing she couldn't afford to leave behind. She was pretty certain she'd packed it into her bag late last night, after they got home from the Merrimans. But then she couldn't find it. So she had to search her entire room, trying to remember where she might have hidden it when she got home from the beach yesterday. It's a lot easier to hide stuff from Mom in her room back home, where she has tried and true spots no one would ever stumble across. Not that Tess ever had much of anything to hide until now. Just her diary, and a bag of M&Ms. Mom doesn't like her eating in her room. And a forbidden DVD of one of those NC-17 slasher movies Mom wouldn't let her go see when her friends did. Nothing like this. In the end, after all that searching and worrying this morning, she finally found what she was looking for. She had tucked it not into her duffel bag, but into a zippered compartment of her camera case where she knew neither of her parents would ever look. Brilliant hiding place. Even you couldn't find it.
"Do you know what you want, Tess?"
Dad asks, cutting into